Hello, everybody. It's Dan and Andy here from the podcast No Such Thing as a Fish, which you're already listening to.
Yeah. Why are we here, Andy? We're here to let everyone know that they can see us in the flesh.
I thought we were here as a social thing. I can't believe it. You lured me into recording an advert.
I know. The other two saw through it. That's why it's you and me alone. But basically, we are concluding the UK and European leg of our Thunder Nerds tour. We only have four dates left. We're going to be playing Cardiff. We're going to be playing London twice and Manchester. And then kaput. That is it. It is over. And we still have some tickets left for a few of those shows. So if you want to come and see us, now is the time to get them.
That's right. You can get tickets. There are still some available for Cardiff, and there are still some available for the second London day. So Cardiff is on the 16th of October at the Wales Millennium Centre. London is, the first one is sold out completely. The second one, there are still a few tickets left. That's on the 24th of October at the Theatre Royal on Drury Lane. So a couple of tickets are available for those two shows, and I'd say buy them now, before the show.
Yeah, we can't wait to see a bunch of you there. It's so fun. We have exciting guests. We have quizzes that we do on stage. We record an original new podcast each time, and we usually get a lot of weird stuff out of Andy to do with a very specific sci-fi movie. So,
yeah,
a little teaser there. So, why don't you come along? Come and see us live. Go to nosuchthingasafish.com. All the links are there to get your tickets from, and we'll hopefully see you there soon. All right, let's get on to the actual podcast itself.
Are we going to order a coffee at any
point? No, I'm going home now.
Okay.
All right, on with the show.
Bye.
Hello and welcome to another episode of No Such Thing as a Fish, a weekly podcast, this week coming to you live from Newcastle. My name is Dan Schreiber. I am sitting here with Anna Tashinsky, Andrew Hunter-Murray, and James Harkin. And once again, we have gathered around the microphones with our four favorite facts from the last 7 days. And in no particular order, here we go. Starting with fact number one, and that is Anna.
My fact this week is that British children have been asked to stop digging holes on beaches after they dug one so big it had to be filled in with a forklift truck.
Mm. Wow.
They're hard to get rid of, and this is a waste of public resources, or this farmer's resources. So this was the Coast Guard in Padstow who had to deal with this one. It was 8 feet deep.
That's deep.
And 9 foot wide.
Yeah, that's sort of more of a trap than a harmless beach activity, isn't it?
It is.
Well, I think I was wondering why it was so wide, because I'd always just make quite narrow holes. But if you're going that deep, you have to get people in it to dig it, don't you? So yep. I suppose it does need to widen. But that does make it really hard to fill in. Takes ages. They had to call Charlie Watson Smythe from Padstow Farm, and he popped over and filled it in with his forklift truck.
Yeah. Have you guys heard of the St Andrews Hole Digging Society?
No, is it to do with golf? It sounds like it.
It's not. Oh. It's a beach thing. So it's only been going a few years, but I'm sure it'll last for many more. So every fortnight, you just go onto the beach and you start digging a hole.
Is it in St Andrews in Scotland?
Yeah.
Cool.
And most people contribute to one main hole each time, but you can do your own thing. They're not prescriptive. And basically, it's the guy who founded it said it's a really nice way for men to do something together where... You don't have to make eye contact with each other. And that is what all men's activities basically are.
Do they cover up the holes at the end of the night?
I think they might fill it back in. I think they might be responsible diggers.
So when the wife said, "Where have you been?" they say, "Oh, we were digging holes, but we filled them all in." But that's honestly what we were doing.
I think that's really nice.
It's nice.
Yeah,
it's
great.
See
nice.
You. I think that is just going against the public service announcement that I was trying to make with this fact. Now you're telling everyone about the society where you go and dig a hole.
That's true. I think they are very dangerous. The other week, I was on a beach and my son dug a hole which couldn't have been more than, I think, 30 centimetres deep, right? And it was quite wide. But he put a little blanket over it.
Brilliant.
And he said...
and he said, "Daddy, come over here. Yeah. I've got something for you."
And did he leave a little plastic Loch Ness Monster on the...
Dad, I found it.
He said, "Dad, come. And I knew, because I'd watched him dig the hole, right? And I sat down, obviously faking it, and fell into the hole.
Right.
Fenella, my wife, had to pick me out of it. My back was gone. Wow. It was so embarrassing from just like that.
Really?
So, you know, you've got to be careful.
Genuinely, they're dangerous. They can even be lethal.
Some more dangerous things on beaches.
Yeah.
Umbrellas.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Due to wind, they send approximately 3,000 people to hospital every year in the US.
No. Wow.
According to the US Consumer Product Safety Commission.
They don't send them literally by holding on and flying off to...
This is Mary Poppins, yeah. Yeah.
Just next to the H for the helipad, there's a little U.
lightning. Because as we all know, lightning doesn't strike at sea. As
regular
listeners.
Don't write in again. Listen, I made a claim that lightning rarely strikes at sea.
And a lot of people just selectively didn't hear the word rarely and have been inundating the inbox.
Well, the truth is that it does rarely strike at sea, but if you're on the beach, you're often going to be the tallest person. Or not the tallest person, but the tallest thing.
On a beach, yeah.
On the beach, right? Because there's not buildings around, there's not trees around, so you might get hit. And, of course, jellyfish. Yeah. And what do you think? Should you wee on jellyfish stings? What do you think, people of Newcastle? Yeah. Okay, there was a very loud yes, but I think that was more recreational than medical.
It's
a no.
It doesn't really help, does it?
No, there's been 10 papers that have tested it, and none of them were positive. About half of them have said it makes matters worse, and half said it doesn't make any difference at all.
Makes matters worse? What, because now you're embarrassed as well as a thing?
What you need to do is apply baking soda slurry, which is 50% baking soda and 50% seawater.
Now.
But that is for all jellyfish, apart from Charybdia marsupialis and Chrysaora hysocella, in which case you absolutely must not apply baking soda slurry.
Oh, what happens?
It makes it way, way worse.
Is it like when you put Mentos inside a Coke bottle? Is it just...
See, I think that's a good argument for just weeing on the wound. Probably won't make it too much worse. The odds of getting it wrong... I don't have time to do a DNA test on this jellyfish. That's just stung me.
Surely everyone knows a Chrysaora hysocella when they see one.
Oh, yeah. That's very funny. I found a professional sandcastle maker...
Did you?
Who, I read a profile of her. Oh. She's called Janelle Hawkins.
Okay.
It just sounds a lot like James Harkin.
Does it?
That's why we were supposed to be surprised by that.
A bit like James Harkin. Okay. Janelle Hawkins.
Janelle Hawkins, yeah.
Spooky.
Very spooky.
Spooky.
The thing is, Andy, I am not a sandcastle maker.
No.
Did you have anything else?
And I noticed that I, by default, was defending you, but even I was not into that one either.
Is that all on her? Can we move on, or is it?
Let's move on.
Okay, great.
Okay.
So it is worth digging holes on some beaches.
Yeah.
Specifically, Folkestone Beach.
Oh.
So quite a long way for you guys to go in Newcastle, but if you are in Kent, there are still gold bars buried there.
I've been to Folkestone Beach as a child. There are gold bars under the surface.
Yeah. Well, you're an idiot. You could have come away a millionaire. Well, not a millionaire technically, but in 2014. So actually, after you were a child.
Thank you.
In 2014, an artist called Michael Salesdorfer buried £10,000. Worth of gold bars there as an art installation. Quite a cool idea. He said, I'm making a constantly changing sculpture because everyone's going to be constantly digging up the beach. And I know it's making someone else do as well for him. But if you dug up one of these bars, of which there were, I think, a lot, about 30, they were either worth £250 or £500. And some people said they dug them up, but we reckon there are quite a few left.
Cool.
So it's worth it.
Good to know.
Yeah.
A lot of people spend their life digging, right? Like for various reasons, for work, we're on a beach, where it's like we're constantly just digging holes into the ground. And I always thought, I wonder, like, you know, how close to the center do you get when you're digging down? So the deepest hole we've ever dug, which was in Russia, has gone down 12,376 meters. That's the deepest one. And that is called the Kola Super Deep Borehole. To put that in context, if you scaled the earth to the size of an apple, the depth that we've gone hasn't even broken through the top layer of skin of the apple.
Yeah. But that's the earth is almost the opposite of an apple, in that with the apple, the best bit is the stuff inside and the crust bit is rubbish. Whereas on the earth, I think one of the reasons we haven't gone down is it's not really nice down there, is it? It's not like if we... Do you think if we just go 15,000 metres, we'll be like, oh, my God, there's a whole other...
No, they couldn't go any further. They didn't get 13,000 metres down and went... It's not great down here.
Dan, I love the idea of your son putting a little tartan blanket over the Kola Super Deep Borehole and leering you over to it.
Have you seen the Super Deep Borehole?
Yeah,
it's pretty small, isn't it?
It's
you couldn't
tight.
Fall down it, I don't think.
No,
I said
no.
I couldn't fall
you could.
It's
could.
9 inches across.
Yeah, and there's all that's on top of it is like a little manhole cover that it really looks like you could just undo.
Yeah.
If you dropped a pebble in it, you bet you couldn't even hear it hit the bottom.
I shouldn't think so.
No.
We're so much better than all other animals at digging holes. But I was...
Do you mean with our hands? Like
No, sorry, with because we've built those amazing machinery. So other animals don't go that far into the ground.
That feels a bit unfair, Ben.
It is.
That's like saying we fly better than any animal because we have...
Yeah, well, true as well.
Yeah.
I was just surprised that the animal that has dug the second deepest aside from us. And I think it's cool and terrifying.
What is it?
A Nile crocodile.
Yes. No. What?
Isn't that cool that they go... With those
little arms?
They actually do it terrifyingly with their jaws, apparently.
Really?
Wow. And they've gone down 12 metres, which is...
That's quite a lot less than us.
Yeah.
It does sound terrifying.
It's a distant second place, isn't it?
Yeah.
Is it because they realised sooner that there wasn't nice apple-y stuff down there than we did? Right.
Deepest hole in Newcastle?
It's... I'm not going to answer that, in fact.
Nice. But there is an official deepest hole in Newcastle.
It's just outside St James's Park, isn't it? In fact, it's just down there. It's just the other side of this.
The science one.
The one that's 2,000 metres. Yeah,
yes.
Really?
The Newcastle Science Central Deep Geothermal Borehole. They wanted to dig a geothermal hole, you know, dig down.
Right.
You've got free hot water forever.
And that's near St James's Park.
Yeah. Yeah.
Andy, another hole and James connection. I'm back on board, baby.
Yeah.
The last one wasn't really a hole connection as much as a sandcastle connection.
I'm back out, baby.
But I found a headline in the local newspaper. Is it the Chronicle? What has the borehole done for Newcastle? Conclusion was very little, sadly.
Well, it gave us, it made us know that Newcastle many, many million years ago was a tropical environment.
Mm.
I don't know what you can do with that information.
Right.
But maybe that's why people in Newcastle go with their tops off all the time, because they're harkening to a better time.
Long memory.
I have a hole digger, a favourite hole digger person.
Who is it?
Well, I realised as I said that it's actually someone who specifically didn't dig his own holes. He had holes dug for him.
Okay.
But it's Bernard Clairvaux, who it's one of my favourite people because I'm quite into medieval Christian sects, and he was the founder of the Knights Templar.
She said sect.
Oh, it was sect.
Yeah.
Grow up,
guys.
That's a hell of a Tinder profile, yeah. Isn't it? I'm really into medieval sects.
I own my own wimple. I will bring my own root screen. Yeah.
We're all having to readjust now to just be interested in what you're about to say as opposed to
what we
were hoping you were going to say.
Picturing sort of monks with dildos floating around.
Okay, Anna. Did you have a fact here? Or
sorry. Bernard Clairvaux. Yeah, yeah, co-founder of the Knights Templar. He was this abbot, very, very leading Christian thinker. And this just goes to show what good friends will do. So the fellow monks at the monastery absolutely adored him. He was their spiritual leader. They knew that he was so devout that he went to excessive lengths. He went to excessive fasting. So he would starve himself, basically, to show his devoutness. And that caused gastric problems. But he was so busy praying in the chapel that he never wanted to leave until the last minute. So he could never get to the loo in time. So his monks... kept on digging and redigging him a poo hole just outside the chapel so that he could dash out at the last minute, drop the cassock, you know, plop in there and dash back in. And that's friendship.
That's beautiful. I was going to quickly, there's lots of different types of holes. So I was going to do a very quick quiz to see if could guess what these holes are. So here's the first one, Yule hole.
Christmas hole. It's the opposite of a Christmas tree. You just dig a nice Yule hole. If you can't afford a tree, trees are expensive. You just throw the tinsel in the hole. Lovely.
Yeah. He's got it right. No, it's obviously not right. So a Yule hole is... I saw this from Susie Dent on Twitter. It's a term for the loosest notch on your belt reserved for Christmas feasting so that when you put a bit of...
Very nice.
..bit extra on, you can use the Yule hole in your belt.
That's great.
Assholes.
Come on.
What are those?
Donkey holes. Holes for donkeys.
Yeah. It's donkey holes. This is amazing.
It's not a donkey's asshole. It's not an ass okay. asshole. It is out in the desert areas. Donkeys make holes that create desert streams, and they provide water holes.
They're not called for all assholes.
They are called assholes. This was in a scientific paper that I read.
Scientific paper.
Yeah, and it's a remarkable thing because not only does it feed the donkeys, the horses, and their predators, up to 57 other species go and sip from these assholes. But then when they dry up, they become nurseries for germination. And,
no, you're not sending your kid to the asshole nursery.
It is time for fact number two, and that is Andy.
My fact is that during the Hundred Years' War, every goose in England had to donate 6 feathers to the war effort. So, Hundred Years' War, England, France. Very exciting. Lots of...
Not that exciting. I mean, no, as far as wars go, it was a long one, wasn't
long
it?
Long periods of inactivity. Yeah, 116 years long, mostly dull. But during the hot bits of the war, England needed enormous numbers of goose feathers because they needed enormous numbers of arrows. So obviously, English army, mostly archer-based at the time, like Agincourt, 80% of the troops there were archers. And, you know, in 1421, the government had to buy 500,000 arrows, and all of them needed goose feathers to put at the blunt end to help the arrows
to
fly through the air and hopefully, like, a Frenchman.
Yeah.
So that was the whole name of the game. And where are the geese? You know, what a nightmare to organise. But fortunately, pretty much every village in England had a flock of geese just hanging around the village pond. And in 1417, King Henry V ordered that his sheriffs take 6 feathers from every goose in the land and deliver them to the Tower of London. So this this was a way that...
So did they send all those sheriffs out to all the towns just plucking... God.
I guess the sheriffs were, they might have sent under-sheriffs or whatever, but it was a huge, huge endeavour. And, you know, like, Battle of Crecy, 1346, sorry, so way earlier than this. But the English archers, on the day, fired 500,000 arrows in one day. 80 per archer. It's a lot. It's so many feathers.
Yeah, they've got orders of like 1,000,000 feathers from like one area of England that they need. Yeah. I mean, because also when you're building an arrow, it's not just the feathers, obviously. You need the wood in order to make the stick bit between the blunt end and the sharp bit.
Yes.
You need...
That's vital.
Yeah. And by the way, there was someone who was designated the official gatherer of all the sticks that sat in the arrow.
What?
But, yeah. He was given the ability to just walk into any forest in the UK and commandeer it.
No.
I'm commandeering your forest.
Oh, I thought you meant he was given the right to look for good-looking sticks on the ground. That one's fantastic.
Yeah. I think his job meant he could go anywhere in the UK and point at a stick, and it was that stick that was now
Did
his.
They not just get bigger bits of wood and whittle them down?
Yeah.
Did they just have to look for exactly the right stick?
No. He could chop down trees and he could do whatever he wanted.
Yeah.
He could just point at things.
That's very cool.
Yeah, because they also needed the wood for the bows as well, didn't they? And it was illegal, actually, to make clogs out of ash. For that time, you weren't allowed to make wooden shoes because they needed it for the bows.
Oh, really?
And that presumably at the time was one of the most fun things you could do was make some clogs out of ash. So that was a sacrifice.
It's a different time.
I think this is a good theory that basically geese were way more important to the war effort than, for example, horses.
Okay.
As in, if you didn't have horses, you know, like, okay,
but who,
war.
But, let me ask you, who is collecting the sticks for the arrows? Really, it's that guy's dog, isn't it? So,
well,
surely that's where dogs collecting sticks came from, the origin.
It may be. Yeah, you're right. It's a team effort.
Yeah.
Well, they had to get the arrows to the battlefield as well.
Yeah.
So they were often taken by horses. They would have huge wagons there because each archer could shoot for about 5 minutes or so with the arrows that they had. And then they had to get more arrows because you can't just bring them all to the front, right?
Right.
And so there was a wagon there and they always had like a battalion of young boys who would run to the wagon, grab the arrows, and run to the front to give the arrows to the archers.
That's a cool job to have.
Would you bring emergency geese with you on the battlefield?
Oh, almost certainly. Every archer would have 2 or 3 geese just in his back pocket.
You're saying that like you're joking.
Yeah.
And
I don't think you would.
But surely when you run out of arrows and you need to emergency make a new one,
the process of making an arrow is so time-consuming.
Yeah.
It's like saying, would you have a bullet maker on the battlefield in case you ran out?
Right. But once you ran out of arrows... That's the end of the battle.
You just go home.
Well, I guess you go collect them, right? If they've worked.
if they've worked.
Do you think, yeah. It's not like darts, where once they're in the board, then you pop over and you pluck them out. So, okay, stop the war, everyone. Should we just collect the arrows and then we'll do it again? Do we know how pedantic they were about the goose feathers? Because I read that traditionally it had to be feathers from the male goose that were on the outside of the arrow, and then the two stabilizing feathers had to be from the female.
Oh, wow.
And I think there was a rumor that this made it fly better, but I think it was irrelevant. That was just the tradition, and I'm not sure you could tell. So I wonder how pedantic Mr. Sheriff was.
I imagine at the start of the war, they were quite pedantic.
Yeah.
And by year 115, they were probably like, any old feather will do.
Yeah.
Because actually, I think it was, most people did use goose feathers, but if you were really fashionable, you might use a peacock feather.
In your arrow.
Yeah, that is classy.
That's classy, cool. Isn't it?
You know you've been shot by an aristocrat when you look there and you see a peacock feather sticking out of you.
Oh, fancy. Yeah. Was this the kind of the final last hurrah for the goose's war effort?
Probably was the last big
major
effort.
Time where it was like the dominating thing. Because they were starting to bring in right at the end at about 1430, there were battles going on where cannons were starting to be used. But it's quite funny reading the accounts because they were quite shit back then. So there was a battle where the Duke of Burgundy fired 412 cannonballs into a town and only succeeded in killing one chicken.
Quick, get all the feathers! I think goose feathers were used a bit later for fuses. Like, because the feather, the hard bit of the feather is hollow, you could kind of stick it in and put gunpowder in it and set fire to it and then run away.
That's nice.
I'm pretty sure that was true.
Oh, that's nice that they sort of stayed useful. That's lovely. Because geese are big players in the world of human history.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Everything that was written between about 600 and 1800 AD...
was done by a goose.
Yeah, very, very patient goose, yeah. No, but the quills that we used to write, they were pretty much all goose. You could use a peacock or a swan or whatever, but...
Isn't it crazy as well that you can get left-hand and right-handed quills based on which wing you took the quill off?
Is that
true? It had to be. Yeah. It's much nicer if you're left-handed to use a right wing of a goose and vice versa,
because
of the way that it curves.
Okay.
But I hadn't realised that the reason the demand was so huge was that they didn't last very long at all. Because I guess you're sharpening them all the time, so you're lucky if your quill lasts a week. If you're having a big letter, if it's someone's birthday, then your quill's going to last a couple of days. Actually, I suppose you only write one birthday card, don't you?
Yeah. It's Christmas.
If it's Christmas, thank you. If it's Jesus' birthday.
Yeah. But where we get penknife from, the word penknife is a knife to make a pen from a feather, which I'd just never made that connection before.
Oh, yeah.
I think the word pen might come from feather.
Certainly does. Yeah. Penna. Yeah. One of my favourite etymologies, pen and pencil come from completely different roots. Because, penna comes from feather, going back to Latin, whereas pencil comes through Old French from, I think, a word that means little penis.
I think you're right.
Really? Okay.
But, yeah.
That is good.
Totally different etymology.
My favourite is that assholes comes from the...
No.
My favourite is, does anyone know why ducks are called ducks? It's because they duck. I only learned this the other day.
That's so
absolutely
crazy.
Incredible.
It's like, because they duck underwater, everyone was like, oh, duck. Duck, and it's
so,
duck.
So humans were ducking sort of before ducks were ducking?
The words, as in the words, yeah. I mean, ducks were ducking from...
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah.
What did
we
call them before? Just nothing. We're just like, I can't even acknowledge that.
And there was a few different... One thing, we used to call them arse feet, didn't we, ducks?
Did we?
Yeah, because they're always flapping their feet underneath their arse.
Oh, because when they're ducking, they've also got their bum sticking out of the water.
Yeah. Anyway.
Oh, yeah. But we're not talking about ducks, we're talking about geese.
Let's talk about golf. Let's talk about golf. Because really? Goose feathers were used in golf balls.
Oh, really?
For a long time, actually. And that was kind of what kept posh people playing golf and non-posh people not playing golf. Because they were so expensive. And the balls were so expensive, they were even more expensive than the clubs in those days.
Okay.
And the way you would do it is you would get a load of goose feathers and you would put it in some cow hide or something. Okay. And then you would soak it all. And that made the leather get smaller, but it would make the goose's feathers get bigger. And that kind of made a really, really solid ball. And it was a perfect ball for playing golf.
Wow.
Do they bounce, those ones?
You don't really need your golf ball to bounce.
Okay.
Not so much.
You're thinking of basketballs.
Oh, no.
Yeah, I know.
But when you were making these golf balls, every golf ball had a top hat full of feathers in it. Whoa. That was how you would measure how many feathers you needed.
No.
Get a top hat, fill it with feathers, and that was the right amount.
Really? So they're really shrinking down.
Oh, yeah.
Very whimsical.
Yeah. Wow.
I've got a riddle for you.
Ooh.
Great.
In the 1980s... the USA hoarded 1.5 million pounds of goose feathers in a strategic reserve. Why?
Pillow fights?
No.
Nope.
Okay.
Well, they had, say it again, they had it all in one, like, building.
Well, I don't know about the exact administrative distribution of the 1.5 million pounds of goose feathers. They might have needed a few sheds or whatever.
Or right. A hole. Could have been in an asshole.
No, I don't. We're not making asshole a thing. It's not happening. Why?
Why?
Just had a guess.
Is this for when we go back to the olden days and we have to rely on bow and arrows because a nuclear blast has wiped out our guns?
Nice guess. It's actually for if we need to go somewhere cold. It's just to make duvets. It's basically sleeping bags and boots and Arctic weather kit.
Yeah.
It's if suddenly we need to fight in the Arctic. Then you just have a strategic reserve in case.
So when James said pillows, he was right.
No.
Said, James said pillow fights. Completely different thing. Frivolous in times of war.
Well,
that's interesting.
Anyway, just that was part of the...
And are they not there anymore? Is it worth attacking Alaska is what I'm asking.
It certainly is.
Guys, I need to move us on. Do you want to sneak in anything before we...
Another use for a goose.
Okay. Yeah.
I'm sure you guys know this, but Rabelais wrote in Gargantua, I wiped my ass with a hen, with a cock, with a calf skin, with a... Come on. With a hare, with a pigeon, with a cormorant, with an attorney's bag.
Attorney's bag?
But of all the tortules, arse wisps, bum fodders, tail napkins, bunghole cleansers, there is none in the world comparable to the neck of a goose.
How big a vindaloo had this guy had that it took all of that?
Poor goose.
All right, we are going to move on to fact number three. It is time for fact number three, and that is my fact. My fact this week is that American comedian Lucille Ball's teeth could play the latest pop songs and bust Japanese spies.
Mm. Wow.
If you were around Lucille Ball at the right moment, if you stuck your ear to her mouth, you could hear the latest pop songs. And
this is so stupid.
No, but it's true.
Was she singing them?
She wasn't singing them.
Okay.
No, it was legit the pop song. So 1952, she was filming a movie, DuBarry Was a Lady, with Red Skelton. This was during World War II. And she had recently just had some temporary lead fillings put into her teeth. And as she drove home from the MGM studio, she said, one night I came into the valley and I heard music. I reached down and turned the radio off and it wasn't on. The music kept getting louder and louder. And then I realized it was coming from my mouth. I even recognized the tune. My mouth was humming and thumping with drum beats, and I thought I was losing my mind. I thought, what the hell is this? Then it started to subside. I got home, went to bed, not sure if I should tell anyone what happened because they would think I was crazy. Anyway, she told this to Buster Keaton, the comedian who she was good friends with, and he said that she was picking up on radio broadcasts through her fillings and that the same thing had happened to a friend of his. And a lot of people were reporting this at the time. And then she suddenly heard coming through her teeth this sort of... And she reported it to someone, and that person said, that could be Japanese spies who were trying to send
what a reach.
Morse code to each other.
It could have been just the start of Inspector Morse.
But your lead fillings get radio?
You need some metal in there which is going to receive the radio waves, and then you need something in there that's not quite solid that can vibrate. And the radio waves will make that vibrate and will make the sound come through. Because it has happened in history. There's an example in the American Journal of Psychiatry where a 35-year-old war veteran thought he was hearing voices, but it turned out he was getting a local radio station.
Wow.
There was a 65-year-old man who had hip replacements, and the doctor was checking his feet, and so put his stethoscope to his feet and could hear you know, Taylor Swift or whatever it was.
Really?
Because it was vibrating through his hip replacements.
That's
so
brilliant.
This has happened.
And has it ever been loud enough that if you're like, oh, I can't quite get the signal for Classic FM, you can say, oh, let's go around to Barry's house.
Gather around Grandad's hip.
Yeah.
That's really funny. This is a field of study at the moment. So the US Army has just got the molar mic. Raphone, which is a radio that clips onto your tooth, basically.
Uh-huh.
And it transmits you signals through your jawbone. So
cool.
The sound goes into your jaw and just goes straight to your auditory nerve. So you can hear.
Oh, I see.
A big advantage if you don't have to wear a microphone if you're up to your neck in a swamp or whatever.
Yeah.
Nice.
And they are testing us at the moment. So
that's actually, weirdly, we talked about Beethoven on last week's episode, and I don't think we mentioned that his friend designed for him something like that, didn't he? When Beethoven went deaf, he designed a contraption that he put on his jaw, against his jaw, that conducted sound for him so that he could hear better what he was playing, and it attached to his piano.
Didn't he have to bite his piano to hear it?
I think he did have to bite down on the piano.
That was the prototype, him biting. Yeah, and then his friend was like, I'll make you a straw, mate. Yeah,
okay.
and built like a metal rod.
Wow.
That kind of, yeah. Just so that in case anyone doesn't recognize the name Lucille Ball, I'm talking about I Love Lucy, one of the greatest comedians of all time. I mean, quite often voted the greatest American TV comedian of
and
all
I
time.
And I Love Lucy was a sitcom that she made, right?
Yeah, yeah. She was incredible. She's going to have her day very soon where she gets that second wind of championing.
She died 30 years ago, so I don't know why Dan thinks she's going to get a second wind.
No, I mean, as in, like, someone's going to say she's my favorite and we're all going to watch her movies again and so on.
Dan's new podcast, I love Lucy.
Which is entirely in Morse code, only receivable by your teeth.
I didn't realize how huge she was. So yeah. there was a thing of in one of the shows, her character gives birth, and I think it was the first time any American TV had shown a pregnant woman going to hospital as a character.
Yeah, yeah.
44 million people watched that.
Yeah, it's
which is
insane.
Just stunning, crazy numbers.
72% of American homes.
Right. Like, America used to shut down on a Monday night because that was the night it was broadcast. And weirdly, in that episode, she gave birth the same night that her character gave birth on TV.
Yeah. So not that weirdly, because she booked in a cesarean for that day.
Yeah.
Ooh.
Oh. So I Love Lucy was possibly the first major TV comedy that was pre-recorded. Up until then, you were doing live TV, everything went out live. And she and her husband, Desi, they innovated the multi-camera live audience pre-record. So when that show did go out, it was timed so that she would give birth on the same night. But what's amazing as well is, Andy, not only was it the first time they saw someone going to deliver a baby, but they couldn't even use the word pregnancy on the show. So the episode wasn't called Lucy is Pregnant. It was called Lucy is Enciente. Because it's a different word for pregnant. I forgot to write which language down, but it's...
I assume it'll be Spanish because famously her partner in it is Cuban.
Oh, yes. Exactly.
And I think whenever they refer to pregnancy, they would say she was expecting, right?
Yeah.
They would never say she was pregnant.
Exactly.
It's mad. It's like it was a swear word. It's absolutely bizarre. Did no one know about pregnancy then?
Actually, one of the facts that someone in the audience sent to us today said something like... I think it was 1974, and it was the Formula One, and they refused to show it on the BBC because one of the teams was sponsored by Durex condoms. Like, all the other teams were sponsored by cigarette brands.
Yeah.
But they were like, no, condoms, definitely can't have that on our TV.
Yeah, and when they did the pregnancy announcement script as well, they had to, because you in TV land, often you have to give it to people who are looking to see if there's anything that can be offensive. So the BBC have, James, what's it called when they have to have a pass through it to make sure it's okay?
Spoil spots.
That basically.
Compliance.
The compliance was not only done by someone who was in-house, part of the network, but it had to be handed to a priest, a rabbi.
No. And they themselves are a joke as well.
Yeah.
look, we're all ignoring the big question about Lucille. Was she a communist?
Oh.
She was accused of being a communist.
Was she?
Yeah, and she was registered to vote as a communist.
Oh, so that says she's a communist.
Yeah, it does.
And people said they went to her house to have communist meetings, didn't they? But she did insist that she wasn't a communist.
She said she was basically hauled over the coals in 1952 by the McCarthyite
you know, when the sort of commie hunting fever was at its absolute height. And, you know, she gave evidence. She said, yes, I was registered to vote as a communist in the 30s, but it was only to please my elderly grandfather.
Very good.
Joseph Stalin.
I love Lenin.
Yeah. Yeah, there was a movie about Lucille Ball, wasn't there, quite recently, and there's a big scene in that where her husband comes out in front of the audience and says she's not a communist, and he said, the only thing red about Lucy is her hair, and even that's not legitimate.
That's very good.
Very good.
It was an amazing relationship. Must have been quite... I don't know. It's, we all get excited by celebrity relationships. Well, I don't, because I'm above it, but many do. And they were one of the originals. Desi Arnaz was her husband. They'd been together 10 years when they made I Love Lucy, and they played husband and wife in that. They sort of played versions of their own characters, didn't they? And it must have been quite groundbreaking then, because he was a Cuban migrant and she was this ginger person, the TV station said at the time.
It's never been seen on TV before. A Cuban and a ginger.
They had to call her Strawberry Blonde, didn't they? Yeah, yeah.
Just remember, TV was black and white back then as well.
It's more the fact she was white, isn't it?
You can no, they kept on quoting, no one's going to believe that a pale redhead is going to go out with a Cuban. Maybe it was like, if she'd had dark hair, you know, maybe it's slightly more plausible.
Right.
Anyway, there was lots of fuss about it. But they were an amazing relationship, and they did divorce, but they stayed very good friends. But he was interesting as well, Desi Arnaz, and he gave us the conga.
Did he?
Which is quite cool.
What do you mean he gave it to us?
He basically introduced the conga line to the West.
He started, and then another person got behind him. Before he knew it, the entire population of America.
Yeah, right. Yeah. That's, America came to a standstill.
That is a big one, isn't
that
it?
That is a
it's
big
one. And that's obviously not how it started. So it was a big thing in Cuba. So Cubans in America tended to know about it. His father had been mayor of Santiago de Cuba in the 20s. And actually his father had repeatedly tried to ban the conga for being immoral and dangerous and sexy.
Which it is.
But he then set up a club.
It's the sexiest dance I know. I don't know about you guys.
It depends where the conga goes into, isn't it?
Yeah, that's the thing.
What? It doesn't go into anything.
Do you mean if it, which room it goes into?
Yeah.
If you keep it in the kitchen, it's not sexy.
If it goes into the sex dungeon.
I think a conga makes a sex dungeon unsexy rather than the other way around.
Oh man, I'd be so terrified if I was halfway along a conga and I saw them going into the sex dungeon. You can't change the course of the conga. You can't do it. I would just start walking quicker so we get through the sex dungeon faster and hopefully back out into the billiards room or something normal.
Are you ever allowed to jump in front of the conga to avert crisis?
You're not allowed to speed. No, but you can exert subtle pressure from behind. Like, let's crack on.
But pressure from behind is what they want.
Yeah.
Oh no. I started the sex dungeon party. Oh no.
Oh my god.
Anyway.
What
are we talking about?
Lucille Ball.
He started a club. Just to make it clear, club called the Conga, where he introduced conga dancing.
Wow.
And that's how it came to us. Cool. So thank you.
Thank you, Desi. Here's something we've got to thank largely Lucy, but also Desi for. It is thanks to her that we have Star Trek.
Really? Yeah.
Star Trek exists because of Lucille Ball. So Gene Roddenberry had pitched the idea to quite a few productions, Gene Roddenberry being the founder, creator of Star Trek, and not many people wanted it. Lucy said, this sounds fantastic. There's a rumor that she misunderstood what it was because she thought it was celebrities going on treks, basically, Star Trek.
No.
Yeah, because they were talking at a time where Bob Hope was going with USO members to the war zones, and it was a big star power thing.
That's a great name for a show, Star Trek.
It's a better show, arguably.
Yeah. But then she found out what it was about, and she said, this sounds very good. They made a pilot that was rejected, and she said, let's give it another pilot. And it was the second pilot that allowed for Star Trek to be made. And she did that with Mission Impossible as well, and a number of other shows.
Right. Mission Impossible, the old one, which I actually didn't know was a thing.
Anna.
I'm so sorry.
It's like you don't listen to me at all. the TV series Mission Impossible.
Yeah.
Very cool.
Well, not only was she a nerd, she was a jerk.
Yes, I heard that too.
Yes.
Yes.
The soda jerk.
I just heard she was an unpleasant person to work with.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, in the 20s to the 50s, it was this huge phenomenon. I didn't know how big a deal it was. So it was in drugstores, chemists, basically. But they had soda fountains there. And you'd have the soda jerk working the soda fountain, called that because they jerk the handle as they're giving it to you. But they weren't really, that wasn't their job. Their main job was to be an entertainer. And they were all about punning, wordplay, making up crazy new terms for these drinks. You'd order, like, a cherry Coke, and they'd shout, "Stretch one, paint it red!" And that means they want a cherry Coke. Or
aren't they also the one making the drink? Who are they shouting this to?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think there's another soda jerk behind them who's doing a bit of the back and forth.
Okay,
yeah.
Bit of business. That's great.
You'd order a Mary Garden. Mary Garden was a famous singer, and you ordered a Mary Garden because it made you sing, and that was a drink where you wanted them to spike it with laxatives because you're blocked up and you needed to have some diarrhea.
Oh, my God.
That, you know what? That sounds mad, but I do think that is missing from modern cocktail bars. Where... And if you can just plop a couple of the old shitteroonies in there, that would be... It is time for our final fact of the show, and that is James.
Okay, my fact this week is that the smelliest car at the British Motor Museum belongs to Queen Elizabeth II.
No. Are you allowed to make those sorts of accusations?
It's not an accusation, it's a fact. That's what we do on this show, we do facts.
And
well, some of us.
I'm going to guess that it smelt of corgi.
Oh,
like
just
the car that smelt just had constant corgis all the way
through
it. Okay, well, the people who smelled it dealt it. No, the people who smelled it said it's not a terribly nice smell, but it is very interesting. It has an almost cheesy, fatty smell to it.
Ooh. Is that Philip?
No, so let me just explain how we know this. So there is a guy at York University called Dr. Will Tullett, and he's head of the British part of a European research program into smell. And they're trying to find lots of old smells and kind of save them before they disappear. And they asked people, what kind of smells are you worried are going to disappear? And a lot of people are worried that the old smell of cars is going to disappear. Because now we're all going electric, there's not going to be any petrol cars, cars are going to change, the smell's going to change, we're going to miss those old cheesy smells of cars. And so they thought, well, we need to find the smell of an old car, so what should we do? We'll go to Gaydon in Warwickshire, which is where the British Motor Museum is, and we'll say, what is your smelliest car, please? And they said, well, without doubt, the smelliest one is this Rover from the 1970s that belonged to the Queen.
It's very interesting, because there's this thing about the Queen that supposedly she thought the world smelled of fresh paint, because everywhere she goes, it's just been painted fresh for her arrival.
Yeah, yeah.
So she just smells this all the time. So it might have been a reaction to that. And also, this had a thick carpet added to it, I presume for royal luxury.
That's absolutely right. Oh. It had a thick, curly pile carpet, and it also had windows that were sealed. You know, in case there was a gas attack out there, they wouldn't go out.
Really? So
basically, the smell stayed in there because they got into the carpet and they stayed in there and they couldn't escape because all the windows were sealed. Yeah.
So it could be some occupant just let off a huge fart, shut the door straight away, and it just hasn't been able to get out ever since until these people...
I'm sure it was the corgis. But anyway, if you are interested, then in 2023, they produced some car fresheners with the royal car smell.
Really?
So you can get a little tree in your car. They'll give you the smell of the smelly Queen's car.
That's so great. Good. I would just, while we're mentioning the modifications that were made to her car, we know that the presidential car, the Beast, has things like it has blood in it of the president in case there's an assassination, they need to administer blood.
Really?
There's all sorts of modifications to the car. And I thought, surely anytime the Queen had a car, they pimped the car. So there's that, the windows. There's also, in between the two front seats, there was a little tray that pulled out that allowed her to put her handbag onto the tray.
Oh,
that's just in the middle of her, yeah.
I just remembered, I've seen the Queen's car.
Oh, yeah?
I walked past it once.
Was she in it?
No.
Were you in the Gaydon Motor Museum?
No, I wasn't. It was just, she was visiting the university I was at.
And were you blown away by the car smell? Did you sort of have to...
No, it wasn't a Rover. It was one of the posh cars. It was a sort of, I don't know, Bentley or something.
Oh, okay.
But it has the special huge... You know how some cars have the little sticky-uppy Mercedes thing? The Queen's car had a massive St. George and the Dragon
silver thing on the bonnet.
Wow. Did it?
Yeah, it was quite cool. Quite, I think that was unique. Yeah.
And does the king get any of this shit? Or is it just like, we stop caring?
I think the king does.
Doesn't he use wine for petrol?
Wine and cheese.
Wine and cheese.
Just general smells of cars. Yeah. So the little pine tree thing that they put in cars,
like the
classic car freshener, was debuted in 1952, which is actually the year the Queen became the Queen, isn't it?
She was coronated in 53,
yeah,
but she
became, anyway, she didn't invent it. But it was... but that was not initially in the shape of a Christmas tree or a pine tree. Mm. Do you know what it was originally in the shape of?
Oh gosh. Something smelly. A
candle.
No. It was, I'm afraid, a sexy pin-up model woman.
Was it?
Yeah.
You know,
was it with a big bottom, though, that could be farting? Because it was the era of those postcards on the beach.
No, it wasn't. It wasn't invented in Bognor. No, it was... you know those... like World War II planes, and you'd paint a sexy woman on the side of your plane. You know that kind
like
of...
Like Betty Boo.
Kind of pin-up. Yeah, the pin-up thing.
That was the shape of the first... It was a chemist called Julius Seman. And
Julius...
Yeah, say that surname again.
Seman, it's sort of Finnish. It's got an accent. I don't know how to pronounce. He'd bumped into a milkman recently who said, my truck smells of spilt milk all the time, and it's horrible. It clings to the truck. Can you invent something? And he said, yeah, I'll go and invent the pine-scented thing.
But he just shaped it,
instead of shaping it like a pine tree, the obvious thing to shape it like, because it was the 50s, he shaped it like a sexy woman instead.
Wow. Milk is the worst scent, according to professional scent removers. Worst scent to remove, yes.
Worse than, like, vomit, worse than...
No, I think it's just more common than vomit, to be fair.
There are a lot of smells that will tell you if there's something wrong with your car.
Okay.
So I went onto one of those websites of Garage who told you all the different things. So burning smell means you might have burnt out fuse or the air conditioning is overheated.
All the cars on fire.
Rubber burning could be your brakes or your tyres have an issue. Or your car's on fire, I suppose. Rotten eggs means you have a problem with your catalytic converter. Or your fuel filter.
That's the excuse I'm going to use next time.
But Dan, this is an electric car.
At the end it said, a dead animal smell. This could be an animal that has crawled into the engine and died.
No, this is... Okay, one of the most annoying memories of my childhood, and it lasted so long, was... personal anecdote, but my brother got a pet snake, a little garter snake, and we picked it up from the pet shop, drove it home, got there, opened the cage, it wasn't in it, it had escaped in the car.
A cage?
From then...
I think I see where you've gone wrong. Oh, yeah, he could, but he won't. Don't worry.
Well, he did.
There's a pet salesman who's run out of boxes.
Look, it had actually wrenched open the glass container that it was being kept in.
Okay.
And well, it just escaped. And I think we kept the car for about 5 years after that, and it smelled of dead snake every time you turned on the heating or the aircon. It was so funny. It was such a joke, and everyone who got in our car was like, hey, it's the dead snake car. And it's unmistakable, a dead animal in your car. And they do like it, because there's a lot of like warm, nice nooks to climb into. I think there was a family in Australia recently who the dad was driving along and he suddenly said, oh, got to pull over, pulled over, and a meter-long snake had jumped out of the like air conditioning, the ventilation system, and tried to bite him with its head.
Wow.
And then retreated back in. Yeah.
Well, that's it. So Mazda in 2011 had to recall 52,000 cars because there's a spider, which is called the yellow sack spider, who loved the smell of gasoline. So they were attracted to the car and they would go into the vents and they would just live there. And then the webs that they would build up around it would mess up the pipes and overheat the car. So it was really dangerous. So they had to recall 52,000. So there's literally a specific spring inside this model of car to stop spiders from making homes inside of it. Yeah,
that's really funny.
Yeah,
I'm sorry, I've been so busy trying to think of a kind of the name for a snake that would live in a car.
Okay.
Go on then.
Where'd you go?
Anaconda?
Yeah. That is great.
But I mean, it was my car, so it works on that level.
Oh, shit! Anaconda!
For God's sake, people, this is genius.
I meant that. I meant that. Yep.
That is it. That is all of our facts. Thank you so much for listening. We will see you again. Newcastle, you were awesome. Thank you so much for having us. We can't wait to come back again. For the rest of you, we'll see you again next week for another episode. Goodbye!